From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, how the evolution of Bayshore Town Center in Glendale reflects consumers' shopping habits. We'll talk with the Journal Sentinel's Tom Dakin.
A big thing that developers and mall operators have a better appreciation for that they didn't have even 10 years ago is public space. And you really see that vividly illustrated with Bayshore.
Then SAS Tom Matthews considers the wage disparity between CEOs and their workers. Our wine contributor says some new labor laws in California will cause higher prices for a bottle of wine.
Vineyard workers can no longer work 60 hours like they normally do, although they work far more than that. They're restricted to 40 hours, and it's also going to have a big effect on the wineries because they're limited as to how long they can have these people out there.
And we'll learn about the 730 projection project. Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. Shopping malls in the United States are facing an uphill battle. As online sales have boomed over the past decade, traditional brick-and-mortar stores have seen declining profits and rising rents. But in many ways, this is just the latest chapter of evolving consumer habits and trends. And perhaps there's no better example of this progression than at Bayshore Town Center in Glendale. Tom Dakin is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He wrote about the latest development at Bayshore. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers and starts by explaining how the mall has changed since it was first built in 1954.
It was an outdoor strip center. Back when shopping centers were being built, that's how we did them. You'd have something like Kmart or maybe Penny's as an anchor, and all the storefronts faced outside. Then it got converted into an indoor shopping mall, much like we built in the 60s and 70s. If you think of places like Brookfield Square, Southridge, Bayshore became that in the mid-70s. And then about a little over a decade ago, it was transformed again, this time into a town center. And with the town center, what you did is they kept the old portion of the mall, but then they built all these additional buildings that had an internal kind of traditional street grid, much like you'd see in a downtown area within the mall itself. And you had sidewalks and you had ways to encourage people to walk around once they got to the property. They built parking ramps, which were new for that area, and in order to allow for more development because, you know, you need less land for parking when you go from surface lots to parking ramps. So that all happened in about 2006. The city of Glendale put up quite a bit of money to help make this happen, spent the money up front through a tax incremental financing district, through the expectation that then the new property tax revenue generated by the town center would repay that debt over roughly 20, 25 years. And then once that's done, you have all this new property tax base for your community, for your school district, et cetera. Well, unfortunately, within about 2 years, we're in the middle of the worst recession since the Great Depression. And then on top of that, Amazon and other online retailers kept growing and growing and growing. And as a result, at this point, Bayshore has a pretty high vacancy rate, about one quarter vacant. They had some major anchors, Sears, Boston store close. And as a result, the value of Bayshore declined considerably. So it's no longer providing the same level of property tax revenue to pay down the city's debt. The ownership of Bayshore went from Mall Properties Incorporated out of New York to the lender to the development, American International Group, AIG, also out of New York, very large financial services provider. Essentially, it was a deed in lieu of foreclosure. I mean, basically, the owner tossed the keys to the lender and said, here, take it. It's yours now. We can't pay the debt. We're not going to pay the debt any longer. So AIG at that point had a decision to make. The entity, the small investors group that controlled the property that AIG now owned, that entity could have declared bankruptcy, and that would have been a very, very bad thing for the city of Glendale. I wouldn't be surprised if that would have resulted perhaps in the city itself declaring bankruptcy, because the city would have been saddled with no means of collecting that large debt. And, you know, as a city, you still have to pay your firefighters, your police officers, your sanitation workers, et cetera. Luckily, AIG saw some value in that property, and instead, through a series of negotiations between AIG and the city, there was an agreement created, which has just now been approved by the Common Council and the mayor in Glendale. And that agreement essentially said AIG agrees to wipe off the city's remaining debt. $57 million, wipe the slate clean. But in return, what AIG wanted was the city to help them finance now this latest reincarnation of Bayshore. This time around, the city is going to finance only if the improvements are made. So instead of the city spending, say, $30 million up front, the city spends that money in stages, again, through the new property tax revenue generated by these by this latest series of improvements. So the city is mitigating its risk considerably this time around. And in return, AIG is taking that money, plus money it has and money it's borrowing from PIMCO, which is a very large investment manager out of Southern California. And they are going to tear down the old mall. They're going to relocate the few tenants left in that old mall into current vacancies in some of the newer buildings they built. And then they're going to make some of those newer buildings look better. They're really going to pay attention to these sort of public gathering places at Bayshore. So if you're familiar with the Rotunda area near what used to be the movie theater there, they're going to make that better. They're going to actually put in escalators, which surprisingly they don't have. They are going to improve the public square. That sunken fountain that's been there is gone, which is probably a good thing because what that effectively meant is during the winter months, the public square was inoperable. Now it's going to be open year-round. They're going to green it up. They're going to put in a big LED screen, kind of like what you have at the plaza over here at the Five Sur Forum. And the whole idea is to make it look better, make it a place where people want to be, where people want to gather, make it more pedestrian-friendly for people to circulate throughout the area. And then in addition to that, they will sell off parcels that are created through the demolition of the old mall, the partial demolition of Boston Store's old building, and then you still have the parcel left over from where the former Sears was torn down. And the idea is they'll sell off those parcels to other people, other companies who will develop, will probably get apartments there. I think that's probably going to be the greatest demand for a new use there. We might even get a hotel as a possibility. So it's really now truly going to become a mixed-use development. When all is said and done, it's going to be quite a bit different than what it is now.
You know, you talked about a lot of the history of the Bayshore Mall there. And like I would guess the vast majority of malls in the country right now, it's gone through a lot of different changes, in part because the way we shop has evolved,
right.
The things we're looking for in those places has evolved. How does this redevelopment compare to other things we've seen, specifically in the Milwaukee area?
Well, we just mentioned a couple of them, and you know, Whitestone Station in Menominee Falls is something like that, where you have that mix of uses, and the retailers there are retailers that are driven not so much by like high-end fashion, but just like everyday type necessity. Like the big anchor, what made Whitestone Station work initially was Costco. Costco's a very large, I mean, you know, they're like very large footprint. They sell everything under the sun. In the case of 84 South, it was largely driven, I think, by Steinhoffel wanting to have a new upgraded store, but also Kohl's wanted to be in there. Kohl's wanted out of Southridge Mall. Kohl's likes to be in standalone locations, so that helped drive that. Now, the Corners is kind of the exception. The Corners was driven by Von Maur, which is higher up the fashion chain for your listeners who are familiar with that. So it's not always the case. But and in all these places, you're also getting retail that's not stores, but more like restaurants, a lot of dining components to these places, a lot of entertainment components to some of these places. And that's what's helping drive the revival of some of the suburban shopping malls. Brookfield Square, you probably know, they're about to get Whirly Ball in there. They're about to get a Marcus Theater and Restaurant Complex. There's a Marcus Theater Restaurant Complex now at Southridge, which also has kind of a game-oriented entertainment center there as well. And again, that's a reflection of what you were just talking about. People are spending less money buying things, but they still like to do things. And that's a big part, again, of what's driving Bayshore. I think what we're going to see at Bayshore is probably a lot of those vacant spaces are going to be filled by food and beverage type businesses. The one big news store we know is going in there is Total Wine & More. They're going to take the old Sports Authority building. So that we do know. But I think a lot of these are going to be food and beverage and more entertainment-oriented type businesses as opposed to places selling stuff.
I will say, when I go to Bayshore Mall, which I do actually with some frequency, I specifically go there for Trader Joe's.
Oh, yeah. That was a big win for them. I mean, and a store like Trader Joe's, think of how often you go to supermarkets. They drive a lot of repeat business. I mean, I don't know how often you go shopping for clothes, but you probably, I'm almost sure you go shopping for food a lot more often than you go shopping for dresses, skirts, pants, you know, accessories, et cetera, right? So,
yeah. So, you know, we've been talking about how shopping trends have really changed over time. And we look at certain malls that are still doing well despite the fact that shopping trends have changed. I'm specifically thinking of Mayfair Mall over in Wauwatosa. What are they doing differently? Are they doing anything differently?
Well, number one, Mayfair Mall is lucky. Let me back up. Their managers are very good, but it also helps to be lucky. It helps to be located smack dab in the geographic center of the Milwaukee metropolitan area. When you're on Mayfair Road at that location, you're roughly equal distance to a lot of different communities that have a fair number of middle and upper middle class households. That's a great location for them to be. But in addition to that, in part because of that, but also because, you know, people running it are good at what they do, they've drawn some good anchor retailers. I mean, the big win for them was Nordstrom. I mean, Nordstrom is a legit type retailer that will actually draw other retailers to your mall. You can't say that about everyone, but you can definitely say it about Nordstrom. Other retailers will want to, as they say, co-locate if there's a Nordstrom at your mall. So that helped because, look, they got Container Store now. That's a big part of what helps them. And, you know, they've done a good job of getting dining options. And then right now, more recently, they have very wisely opted to redevelop that building on their perimeter, the old office building, into what's going to be a very, very nice high-end hotel. Now, they're doing that in partnership with the developer that's coming in. Kyle Striggins and his partners are doing that. HKS Development is the name of the company. But it's going to be, a gorgeous Marriott Renaissance hotel, the only one of its kind in our area, chef-driven restaurant, rooftop, you know, meeting room, et cetera. You know, that can't help but help your mall, right, when you get something like that on the perimeter. So, yeah, and should toss in, the city has helped out. The city helped make that happen with some TIF financing. And the city, the common council, and the mayor there made it quite clear that they didn't like the first plan, which was to tear down the building and put up some kind of middle-tier type restaurants. They said, hey, we can do better than this, and we will help you with the TIF district to do better than this. And so, voila, now you've got a gorgeous hotel going in there that's going to add more value to the property.
When I look at Mayfair especially, you know, you mentioned the dining options, and something that sticks out to me when I compare it to other similar malls, similar insular malls, is a lot of those dining options are actually accessible from outside of the mall. They are more permeable. How important is that in the design of more modern malls?
Well, it's very important. I mean, first of all, it gives those restaurants a ton of visibility. You could drive by a mall, it could have a great restaurant, and you wouldn't know it's there. We see that other properties. Brookfield Square is a good example, where you have a lot of restaurants that in the past decade or so have been built on the periphery. And it's interesting, if you go to Brookfield Square, it can be a little dead inside the actual mall itself, but there can be a lot of activity just on the outside at all those different restaurants on the periphery. And I'm sure Whirly Ball and the Marcus Cinema will have a lot of that activity as well.
When we look at the redevelopment of many of these malls and even urban malls, what do we see as the future of how we design these spaces?
I think a big thing that developers and mall operators have a better appreciation for that they didn't have even 10 years ago is public space. And you really see that vividly illustrated with Bayshore. Bayshore, yeah, they built the little town center, but that was really about it. The rotunda area indoor kind of. When I was at a presentation this week, Kirk Williams, the gentleman with Cypress Equities, and that's the Dallas space firm that AIG has hired to basically do this project, because Cypress, that's what they do. They do development. Kirk put up a slide at this presentation and said, what do you see there? What don't you see there? And what you don't see there is green space. And that, he said, you know, if you were starting over today and doing this, you wouldn't do it that way. You would definitely carve out more public space, because, yeah, you don't make money per se on public space. You're not renting it to a retailer, but you're improving the value of your property because people want to be there. I mean, that's the important thing. Look what's happening right now with the former Grand Avenue. I literally walked past on my way over here for this interview at the corner of Wisconsin Avenue and Old World 3rd Street, what used to be the main entrance of the Grand Avenue. We all know what used to be there, right? The giant glass aquarium that was built, ironically, not built when it was originally opened. When it originally opened in 1982, it had a much more graceful, kind of meets the street appropriately type entrance. But in 2000, 2001, that was during a period when all the rage was to build these ridiculous big glass boxes, as if to say to your potential patrons, I don't know, come on and get trapped inside. I don't know what they were thinking. But at any rate, I suppose it's to make some kind of visual mark. Well, it made a visual mark. It looked horrendous. It'd be like, you know, you put a scar on your face and say, hey, notice me. So what's happening now is the glass box is gone. We're going to create a much more gradual sweep from the street up to the main entrance, which was there, ironically, again, when it first opened. We've removed part of the old Applebee's restaurant. We're going to create a much more appropriately scaled entrance, and we're going to create a public square there. We're going to literally have public space there. It's going to blend into the beer garden that's going to be part of the food hall, Third Street Market Hall, which is going to be sort of the signature development at the Avenue. So, I mean, there'll be some of that space will be for patrons of the beer hall, but it will kind of blend into the public space. And if you want to go and sit in that public space all day and hang out, you're not only free to do so, you'd probably be encouraged to do so because, again, they want people to feel welcome. If you feel welcome there, usually you're going to end up spending money there as well.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing that developers really have a better appreciation for now than they had in prior mall building periods.
Yeah. Well, Tom Dakin, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Tom Dakin reports on commercial real estate for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. You can hear more of our conversations with Dakin about development in the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. It is no secret that the wealth gap in this country is large and is only getting larger. In May, Forbes reported that in 2018, the richest 10% held 70% of total household wealth. That's up from 60% in 1989. And in June, the Brookings Institute reported that the top 1% alone holds more wealth than the entire middle class. Lake Effect essayist Tom Matthews thinks that needs to change.
The New York Times recently published its annual list of CEO salaries at America's top companies. We learned that McDonald's CEO Stephen J. Easterbrook racked up a cool $16 million in cash and goodies last year. That's a lot of Happy Meals. Struggling to afford any meals, meanwhile, was the typical McDonald's wage slave, whose median pay last year was barely $20,000, a pay ratio of roughly 1,000 to 1. This at a time when the national poverty level for a family of four is just under $26,000. I have no idea what the CEO of a McDonald's does. There are probably 15 levels of executives beneath him, each no doubt making well into six figures. And I don't know what they do either. But I do know what these executives are not doing. They are not spending 100% of their workday doing the thing that is McDonald's. Making food, selling food, cleaning up what's left of the food. Directly engaging paying customers to separate them from their cash and pass it up the pipeline to support Stephen J. Easterbrook's summer home. Built almost certainly where McDonald's are not allowed and its lesser employees are never welcomed. Well, come on, the corporate rationalization must go. The burgers almost cook and wrap themselves. Computerized registers calculate the change for the dwindling number of customers who aren't swiping credit cards. And last time we looked, operating a bucket and mop is still the same ideal drudgery for the simple-minded. What, you're supposed to get rich doing that? Rich? No. But how about paying your full-time employees no less than $50,000 a year, which, as established, is merely twice the national poverty rate? Bask in the corporate benevolence that comes from simply allowing your employees to earn a living and raise a family. That whole American dream thing. Slapping on a McDonald's name tag and soaking up the splattering grease, spilled ice cream, and restroom overflows for 8 hours a day is absolutely not glamorous nor complicated. But it is the thing that brought McDonald's $26 billion in revenue last year. Just as stocking shelves, retrieving carts from the parking lot, and directing customers to the underwear aisle was the thing that let Walmart top the revenues list last year with $514 billion. And moving product along a conveyor belt, loading trucks, and delivering packages was the thing that made Amazon's Jeff Bezos the richest man in the world. How hard it is to do the thing shouldn't even enter into it when the thing is clearly being done very well based on revenues. So pay the thing doers a wage that is in meaningful proportion to their role in the company's success. No, the guy scooping my fries at McDonald's doesn't get to make six figures. But only in the most diseased version of capitalism could it be acceptable that the employee at the customer end of the revenue chain should work for less than a living wage for no other apparent reason than the work they do is almost literally worthless to those who benefit most richly from it.
Lake Effect essayist Tom Matthews lives in Wauwatosa. His latest novel is called Raising the Dead. Coming up next, how tariffs and immigration issues will affect the cost of a bottle of wine. Lake Effect returns with that conversation in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. The news has been full of stories on tariffs and immigration and how both are affecting the economy. These aren't topics our wine contributor Ray Pfister typically talks with us about, but he says these national and international policies will show up as higher per bottle prices for the consumer. And one of the biggest changes coming down the pike are with labor laws.
The rules are changing in California, and I believe it is in 2020, where vineyard workers can no longer work 60 hours like they normally do, although they work far more than that. They're restricted to 40 hours, and it's also going to have a big effect on the wineries because they're limited as to how long they can have these people out there.
And these are the people picking the grapes.
These are the pickers. These are the folks that are working out there, and these guys are part of the land. They've been doing it. Some of them are families doing it all their lives. The key is that when the grapes are ready, the grapes are ready. There's no waiting. They measure it with a measurement called Brix, which is a temperature done through a refractometer. And basically, it tells the winemaker generally when they're ready to pick. And if that changes, it puts the winemaker in a bad position. So the grapes got to go. And you can't let them sit out there. Can't let the birds get to them. And again, these are things people don't want to always think about. There are so many issues. But the labor force also, because of immigration issues, people are living in a bit of fear. And they don't know what they can or can't do. The other side of that, of course, is, and I'm going to use Napa as a specific example, is it's very hard to live there and be able to afford it if you're picking. There is a space that is for workers where they can live during harvest, just like they've done in the past, but a lot of them are natives. I mean, there's a lot of second-generation pickers there, specifically Mexicans. And it's expensive to live there. It's expensive for me to visit there. I can't even imagine living there. And it's becoming busier there, too. So a lot of people are traveling from further areas, which adds to their costs. So these all add up in the cost of a bottle of wine, something worth thinking about. And these people who pick have been doing this for a long time, and they're the ones that are going to continue doing it. A lot of everyday folks aren't going to do it.
I was going to say, are those folks typically migrant workers?
Typically. Many wineries have their own crews, and some wineries have had crews for 30 years. And again, they're family members. So when the old man gets older, and women are picking too, kids will take over.
Obviously, the whole immigration issue is going to play into this, and it's going to affect the bottom line and the bottle of wine price that we're going to see. What about tariffs? Are they affecting? I know that's affecting the Midwest a great deal. What's happening with winemakers out in California?
Specifically bottles. A lot of bottles come from China, and they're getting hit with that tariff, and it's going to cause the price of a bottle of wine going up. I don't know about corks. For people who know about corks, they come from Portugal. They actually are bark of a cork tree. And I don't know if that's having an effect at this particular point. It is Portugal, so it's not the same thing. Corks are expensive. High-end corks are more expensive. Longer corks will cost a winemaker more. Although I've heard in the last few years, the Portuguese have spent more time creating better quality corks, which has made winemakers much happier because there's always been this controversy over screw cap versus glass cap versus Cork. I'm a Cork fan. I'm a Cork dork.
Well, I think most people who I know think that if it's not corked wine, it's not good wine. Is that true? I mean, good wine that comes in screw tops.
There's wonderful wine that comes in screw tops. But I'll always use the same analogy one winemaker gave me. He said, I have no problem with screw caps. And once Lafitte starts putting their wine in, Rothschild starts putting their wines in screw caps, I'll do it too. Very commonly, a lot of winemakers will put their rosés, their Sauvignon Blancs, and screw caps, and maybe low-end reds or alternate brand reds. And I think the American public is slowly getting used to it. Australia kind of looks at us and said, hey, get over it. We've been doing this for years.
It doesn't affect the quality.
Not at all. It's an aging issue. And you could have that argument like a political argument, whether it's good, bad, or in between. Studies have shown you really don't get effective aging with a screw cap. A cork does let in a certain degree of air, minuscule, which helps the wine age and become what is desirable. But most Americans want to buy their wine and drink it that night.
Well, and the kinds of things that they're doing screw caps are whites and rosés, which you're not keeping for years anyway.
No, especially rosés. The rosés generally aren't going to be an ageable wine. Why would you want to? And most whites are the Chardonnays and some Sauvignon Blancs, yes, definitely, but they're not going to be in screw caps. And it's a price point thing, too, because many high-end Sauvignon Blancs are going to have a cork in it, and they're selling for a premium price, so you're not going to want a screw cap. And it's the old thing, you go in the restaurant and you're with your partner and, you know, this the crack of a screw cap versus the pop of a cork is a certain different level of romance.
When they start popping the pop tops, you know, then you kind of go, wait, I don't know that I ordered that wine.
Well, and I got to tell you, as a quick aside, man, wine in cans is taking over. It's getting huge. And I've tasted it and I'm embarrassed to say it's actually quite good. I shouldn't say embarrassed, but some people are making some very good canned wines, and it's getting very popular because of ease of getting at it.
And so that pop-top thing really wasn't hyperbole on
nope,
my part.
Not at all.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Well, I'll look for that the next time at a relatively high-end restaurant. It's like that.
Have your waiter bring it to the table. Tap on the lid. Oh, wait, it's not carbonated.
Yeah, don't have to worry about that. You know, you don't want to do that with a champagne or a sparkling wine, I don't think.
I'm not even going to hold my breath at this point. You never know. That's the thing. If there's something out there to be discovered, somebody's going to do it.
Yeah.
This is America. We do things like that. And who knows? Actually, if I remember correctly, Francis Ford Coppola's Sophia, they had made her wine. It's his daughter, Sophia. In cans, and it was a sparkling. I believe it could have been just a rosé, so I'm not going to swear to it.
Okay. All right. Well, next time. Find out next time. So we're at the end of summer. I hate to say that, but, you know, end of August. We're moving into September very soon. What are you drinking right now, and what are you recommending?
I drink everything.
Well, I know you drink everything all the time, but for people who are thinking about the kinds of foods that we're having at the end of the summer,
Sure. What
kinds of things are you really enjoying?
Sauvignon Blanc is one of my favorite wines. I've made the joke, and I made it to you, Sauvignon Blanc in the morning, a little glass of it's not a bad thing. I've grown to like Chardonnay when I find the Chardonnay that makes me smile. Chardonnay is a little more difficult to find something that's suited to the individual because you have the oak, the un-oak, the tanks versus the wood, that kind of thing. I've had both that have made me happy. There's a brand in Sonoma that is one of my high favorites that I just had recently, some slightly older, and I was just smiling like crazy when I had that. And I was really happy I could take that bottle home with me after the interview.
But you prefer the Sauvignon Blanc?
I'm a Sauvignon Blanc hardcore. It's just such a great wine. Sauvignon Blanc and scallops makes me go crazy. It's such a great taste.
So what is it about the flavor of Sauvignon Blanc? Is it a lightness? What is it for you that makes it so special?
I don't know if I called it a lightness, but it is a summery feel. It's an airy feel. It's a fruity feel. If you get from New Zealand, maybe a little more grassy. It can vary just like any wine, but I think it varies more extremely than reds. That's a very broad statement, and somebody will shake their head when I say that, I'm sure. It's just a cheery taste. And I can have it any time. I don't need to have it in summer. I'll have it in wintertime. I'm fine.
And it's not sweet.
No, it's definitely not sweet. And you know, and I drink a lot of Cabernet, and I'll still drink that in summertime. But Riesling is another favorite in summertime. We've talked about it in the past, and I just had a conversation with a winemaker about the whole myth that all Rieslings are sweet. They're not. Michigan, my home state of Ohio, Washington, but very specifically Oregon, are producing amazing dry Rieslings. I cannot recommend them enough, and they are just so full-bodied and tasty, and they go with just about anything.
I've had Rieslings in Germany, of course, which is where they're from, that in Austria, and it's rare to find a sweet one. They will have them, but it's like what you're saying. They're actually almost a table wine.
I think it's an image problem. And again, I'll go back.
Probably the only thing we ever got for a long time was the sweet stuff.
Well, you know, Finger Lakes, another great area, they're making some deadly Rieslings there. But I'll go to Michigan because Michigan is not, even though it is a major winemaker, people don't think Michigan, but they have, gosh, just about everybody there makes Riesling, and many of them are making sparkling Rieslings, and they're wonderful. So it's getting past that, you know, apricot wine or whatever it is thing. Remember.
Boone's Farm.
Right, right. I mean, I can't rap on wineries like that. If they made a living, good for them. But there are fabulous wineries. Again, I'm going to go back to my home state. In Indiana, there's great wineries. There's wineries all over the country. I always tell people, try them first. Know what you're talking about if you're going to put it down. But maybe it'll open your eyes up. And Riesling is a great eye opener.
So good full-bodied dry Riesling, some Sauvignon Blanc. Anything else as we transition into fall?
Cabernet. And Pinot. You know,
you mentioned something before that I personally love a lot, and that's rosé.
Yeah.
I am very fond of rosés in all of their various forms, sparkling, still. I don't like it super sweet, but I like a semi-sweet rosé sometimes.
Yeah, a little feel to it's not a bad thing.
Yep.
Sparkling rosé is just wonderful. It is such a great palate.
It is a nectar of the gods, I think.
It really is. I love it, and I love it from all kinds of different places. Spain, you know, Italy, and certainly here in the States. Rosé, I think people are getting better with it because there were so many years of the image. Oh, it's like white Zinfandel. It's not. It is its own thing, and it's completely different. It's the one wine made from all kinds. You can have Pinot Noir, you can have Cabernet, you can have Zinfandel, and more, a Cabernet Franc. It's very common, and that's what makes it a unique wine because each one's going to be so completely different, and of course, how long it stays on the skins, the color, that kind of thing.
Yeah, because they can be incredibly pale, and they can be blush, and then they can be not quite, you can still see through them, but they're very much, and sometimes even ambery.
That's right.
Yeah,
they do, and the key is the French do generally lighter ones, but if you really do spend the time looking, the hues are very different. You're right, you get a little bit of amber in some of the bottles. It's fun to just compare them, but, you know, buy them, try them, and again, take a picture of that bottle so you remember it. There's an app out there. I don't know if I can mention it.
Sure.
It's called Delectable, which is a great way to remember what you've bought. And you can rate it, and you could talk to other people who will turn you on to wines that are of the same ilk. There are some very heavyweight winemakers on Delectable. And if you want to get a rating from a winemaker, that's the place to get it from.
Very cool.
More so than a critic, in my opinion.
Well, and that's a great way to just learn about new things.
Yeah, exactly. Well, these are the experts, you know, and I'm not totally rapping critics because it's their tastes. And sommeliers are the more objective of anybody on the planet. Those people I have a great deal of respect for. But winemakers, I mean, these guys are out there tasting on a regular basis, let alone their own wines. No winemaker wants a house palate. They want to be able to taste the world. My very good friend Henrik, who I stay with him when I'm in Napa, his palate blows my brain away. We've done so many blind tastings, and he always narrows it. I've only fooled him once, and boy, was I proud.
Something to keep trying for.
That's exactly what it is. One day I'll get him again.
One day you'll get him again.
Exactly.
Well, until then, Ray Fisser, it is always a pleasure to have you in the studio, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Thanks, Bonnie. Good seeing you.
Lake Effect's wine contributor Ray Fisser is the co-creator and voice of the wine blog and podcast Life Between the Vines. Fisser is also the owner and engineer of Fifth Floor Recording Company in the Third Ward. We'll take one last break and then learn about the 730 Projection Project and its current video project. Lake Effect returns in just a moment on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. For the past year, the 730 Projection Project on Wisconsin Avenue has shown photographs taken in the two blocks surrounding 730 North Plankinton Avenue. It is no coincidence that that happens to be the address of photographer Dick Blau, the creator of the project. Over the past decade, Blau has taken hundreds of photos of the area, revisiting this familiar subject in many different ways. But the 730 projection has taken a break from that familiar ground to head just south to Milwaukee's harbor. Winter Layup is a film made of still photographs created by Jim Brozek in the late 70s through the mid-80s. It was when he worked as a seasonal laborer on iron ore boats in Milwaukee's harbor. The images show men at work on these boats in the middle of winter, welding and shaping these enormous ships. Blau and Brozek joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers in the studio to talk about their work, and Blau begins by explaining how the 730 projection began.
It began when I and my sweetie moved downtown to what was the first building that was converted to condos, the old Waldheim's furniture store. And we were lucky enough to find a place on the eighth floor with a glorious view. It was a view not only a panorama to the south, you could see the Bradley clock. To the west, you could see the courthouse, and even more exciting to me, you could see the major intersection west of the river in Plankinton and Wisconsin. So I've been a photographer for many, many years, and for the most part, my interest has been people. But all of a sudden, I was faced with a place, and I became engaged with photographing the world, this new world that I had entered. I photographed day, I photographed night, I photographed every season. I photographed from the eighth floor. I also photographed on the street. And I photographed everything from the beauties of the architecture. This is the great architectural moment in the early 20th century in Milwaukee. It's the Gimbel's Building, the Plankinton Mall, the Posner Building, the Germania Building. So I photographed all of them along with the enormous sky that I had access to and the seagulls across the way. And at the same time, I also photographed all of the transient beauties of the street itself. A scrap of paper next to Moe's Irish Pub where some musician desperate to improve his work had written all of his resolutions. The painting that the workers put on the sidewalks to show where the pipes were. I ended up making a set of rules for myself that the pictures I would make would either be taken inside the building where I lived or within sight of it. So consequently, this was a two-square-block area, a deep dive into this place, seen in every possible aspect. And that was the beginning of the project itself. As I began developing photographs I liked, I saw that there were two spaces in the lobby that could use something. And so I just started taping up every 7 to 10 days, just taping pictures to the wall. These are prints. These are like 30 inches wide, so they're large prints. People in the building found out who was doing it and bought me frames, and I started using the frames. And then as the prints built up in my files, I began to try to figure out what I would do with them. I had hundreds of prints. And I realized that the Milwaukee County Historical Society was just up the block, and they had a really good archive, so I donated 200 prints to them. And then as I thought further, I realized I needed to find some way to actually show these pictures to the public. So I went to Moe's Steakhouse, which is a wonderful, iconic steakhouse on the corner, just slightly south of where we live. And I arranged with them to do four performances in the bar on their big television screens, accompanied by their pianist, a wonderful pianist named Jerry Weitzer. We did four performances of that, 4 hours each. And then I discovered that Moe's also owned a storefront on Wisconsin Avenue itself. So I worked with them and got access to the storefront, painted the window with a special paint, bought a video projector, put two loudspeakers outside the building, and made a film of all of my photographs, 300 photographs in all, accompanied by a soundtrack made according to the same rules, and began projecting the film every night from dusk to dawn. The music would be on from dusk until 11 p.m. so as not to drive the neighbors crazy. And I did that for a year. At the end of the year, I realized that I wanted to actually celebrate not only the year, but also my friend Jim Brozek's work. Jim had sent me a beautiful film that he'd made called Winter Layup. So I've now started to show that film basically in celebration of Labor Day. Runs at the same times. It starts at dusk, ends at dawn. Music is on from 8 to 11 p.m. And so that is the story of the 730 Project.
So, Jim, where does your piece, Winter Layup, where does that fit into this larger project?
Well, I think the idea that Dick is presenting images to the public in a public space in a way that people can comfortably attend it or not attend it or look or walk by, and the sound and the moving images in terms of transitioning back and forth creates a level of experience that's a lot different than just seeing a still photograph on a wall in an exhibition. And so my images evolved into that probably back in 2010, but they made a leap from 1986, and I started actually photographing and working on the ships in 1979, only in the wintertime when the Great Lakes were frozen. But I also just carried one camera, one lens, one type of film, and for 5 years I sort of grew as a photographer. And as Dick would say, it was a deep dive, you know, into an environment. And I found myself kind of photographing as a, as the ethnographer would say, a participant observer. And I did that at numerous other jobs throughout a 10-year period. But this work, I had a show in 1986 at Woodland Pattern, and I created a sound piece with Telly Lesbines and Dave Kenny, and we went into Telly's timpanist studio. We made working sounds, banging away, and that was combined with actual sounds that I recorded from in the interior of the ships. And so that was played as a sound loop and an effort to elevate still images sitting on the wall, being viewed by sound coming in and helping you to interpret or misinterpret or wherever your mind wanted to go. And so in 2010, I decided to marry that sound with the images into a slide movie, and I did nothing with it until I put it up on YouTube or something, and then I showed it to Dick, and Dick, I think, maybe found things in it that resonate with the same kind of intent he had with the storefront, where this film could function in a very similar way interacting with an audience that is not necessarily confined in a gallery.
Well, and I had some questions just about the photographs themselves. And, you know, in journalism, you would kind of call this gonzo journalism, right? But was it something that, was it a project that started with the idea that you would be taking photographs, or did you start working as a laborer on these ships and then went, I should start photographing this?
Well, I had done a project in 1976 working a driving tractor for Fresh Like Vegetables, harvesting peas and corn. And while you're on the tractor, you don't actually get around too much, but I did some portraiture and documenting machinery and stuff. And when this opportunity came up in the middle of, I think, a Reagan recession, I wasn't really into full-time jobs at the time. And the seasonal job really worked out for me so that I could photograph other things when I wasn't working. But I was already carrying my camera, and it never got in the way. And the port captain, I convinced him that I can work just as hard or more than some of the workers I would be working with. And so they began to accept me carrying my camera. And after maybe putting some photographs up on the post, on the cork board, stuff like that. And it was a five winters of a cool experience. I mean, the ships were incredible to work on. And at any time of the day, you'll find people wanting to sneak on board or something because they just love ships. And so here I had this great erector set to play with.
You know, the images are, to me, are very reminiscent of the kinds of images you would find in the New Works projects. The
yes.
The kinds of things you would have found in, I believe that was the 1930s, right?
Sure. One of my favorite photographers was Lewis Hine, and his not only wonderful portraits of the children in workspaces, but also his complete documentation of the Empire State Building being built, which I thought was really cool, and I kind of embraced that later. I had wound up being photographing the Calatrava being built, and so I said, Calatrava, this will be my Empire State Building.
Well, and in some ways, the Calatrava has become so identifiable with Milwaukee as the Empire State Building is with New York.
Yeah, yeah. But again, I wasn't actually a laborer doing that. I was specifically a voyeur, where on the 10-year period between 76 and 85, I was a participant. And so the images, for me, actually capture something about what my body was feeling, you know, swinging the hammer, getting tired, getting cold, whatever. And so some of the images, and maybe some of the more spacey images, are maybe being photographed by me with my body, thinking more than my mind feeling.
More than a voyeur, much more a participant, but
yeah.
But over a long period of time as well. And, you know, that is definitely similar to your work in this project. You know, have you been in your home now about a decade?
Is that? Yes.
And so these photographs, I mean, they start about 10 years ago and they continue to this day. You know, in both of your situations, what do you think you gain from looking at a space, the same space ostensibly, over a long period of time?
Well, actually, one of the things you gain is an ability to look at things and discover their beauties, to bring what is in the background generally of most people's experience, including the photographer's experience, into the foreground in very unusual ways. And that comes both out of your deep familiarity with the subject matter and also the effort to actually see it new. So there's a kind of artistic development involved in this that keeps you fresh and keeps you engaged with the world and brings it to life in very special ways. That's one of the things I think that's really been very pleasurable for my neighbors. I kind of play a game with them. I mean, they're the obvious beauties of the neighborhood, the detail of the Plankinton building or whatever. But I also try to find things that my neighbors pass by every day without looking at, to frame them in a way that actually brings forward their intrinsic interest. If you look at things in a certain way, you can actually vivify your world and your experience in a way that's quite surprising and quite enriching. And I think that comes out of familiarity and learning how to get past the dullness of the daily routine, which tends to reduce everything to background.
I think for me, this particular project, because it was at a time when I was growing as a photographer, not that I'm not growing right now, but the point is that it was every 5 winters, and so I had a little time before I went back, and I had a little time to look at the proof sheets, to look at the proof prints, and go back and somehow be maybe dissatisfied with some things and want to change some other things. And in those days, when you're doing film, you don't have an instant payback. You have to develop it, and all of a sudden you have a proof sheet that you're living with. And I think that for me, the idea of doing images is growing. And I think that when I grew the most, I think, maybe not so much now, but was discovering mistakes on my proof sheets and then also being fascinated by why do I like that mistake? And so you begin to understand some other things about maybe what you instinctively saw when you were taking the picture, but initially you wanted to reject it. But it grows on you. You know, sometimes mistakes do.
And I'm sure looking at the same general subject, or at least the same kind of space, allows you a really great way to evaluate what you've done and ultimately where you're going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the idea of time and space and duration, the time you spend with with a subject. If it's 5 years, it's different than, you know, a 5-minute quick shoot or something.
You know, the 730 project, it's doing winter layup right now, but it's been going on for about a year, and it seems like it will continue to go on. What do you hope your audiences take away from this project?
It gets back to what I was saying about background and foreground. I hope that my audiences actually learn to or inspired to look at the world that they pass through every day in a sharper, more tangible, a more imaginative way, rather than simply passing through as if on a screen, which is what I think many, many people do. It's a very natural sort of impulse. So that's at the base of my ambition for the project itself. I'm also interested in encouraging people to stop, to spend time, to engage, to let go the easy trajectory of life and work, and enter a kind of meditative relation to what they see around them, whether it's my particular project or the world that they live in.
All right. Well, Dick, Jim, thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you very much. It's really a pleasure.
Yes.
Dick Blau is a photographer and the creator of the 730 projection, which is currently featuring Winter Layup, a video project by photographer Jim Brozek. The piece will be on display through Labor Day and can be seen just west of Moe's Irish Pub on Wisconsin Avenue. Dick Blau and Jim Brozek spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It is 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.